inviting me today. This is really not about me, but I just want to give you a little bit of background. I arrived here in Denver actually in 1980 on my way to California. My car broke. I decided I would stay. So I've been working here in Denver and actually lived in probably 7 or 8 different neighborhoods between Cheeseman Park and City Park for years. Now I actually live in Genesee up in the foothills. So I come down every day to my office in Logan. And in the travels over the past couple of years, I realized that, you know, things were changing. And things were changing rapidly around where I live and throughout the Denver corridor and the surrounding areas. And I felt that what was changing was not terrific, it was not great, that we were losing a little bit of our pride in Denver, a little bit of sense of place, a little bit of what makes Denver special. And when you feel that about anything, I think it's important to speak up. So that was my opportunity to speak up. And that's where the op-ed piece actually came from. I'm kind of lucky in a way that I don't do multifamily housing. So I'm able to actually speak about multifamily housing and not worry about sort of ruining maybe that relationship that I might have with a developer out there. Because I'm sure and I know from my conversations with architects that they would have loved to have said what I said, but they can't. Many of them can't. So it gave me an opportunity and it gave me a podium to stand on. So when I wrote the op-ed piece, I really wrote it from a personal level, but also from a city level. And I'm realizing that we really don't need change like this, and we really need to step back maybe and look at what's happening and take the time to look at that. So when I wrote the op-ed piece, I just expected I'd get maybe a few responses from it. By 6 o'clock in the morning, I had 100 emails. 2 days later, I had 500. Today, I have over 1,000 emails from people in the Denver area and surrounding communities. And I have 2,000 emails from people outside of my state of Colorado. So the op-ed piece has now traveled throughout the country. It's in Seattle. It's in Houston. It's in Atlanta. It's actually in Providence, Rhode Island. It's in many states throughout the U.S. And interestingly enough, and I have connections with other architects, I kind of spread it out to them too and asked them, hey, anything like this going on in your woods? Well, they basically took the article and changed the name. Just put a little bit of plagiarism, but it's okay. It basically got their cities and neighborhoods talking about this issue just like I wanted to do, was to get our city and get our neighborhoods speaking about it. I wasn't sure where it would go, and I'm still not quite clear where it would go, but I have taken the opportunity to do a couple of things. One is, I sat down with the AIA, my organization, American Institute of Architects, and I said, look, this isn't just a developer issue, it's not just a builder, a contractor issue, it's not just a city issue, it's an architect's issue as well, that we're not doing a good job, that we need to stand up more for what we believe would make cities more livable, neighborhoods more appropriate. The architects need to do that as well. So I pointed the finger at everybody, not just one entity. And I think that's one thing that's starting to come out now, is that everybody should take responsibility for what's going on. I should take responsibility for certain things too, that if we can just start flipping through the slides, that I showed some examples here. We'll flip through these. I have about 40 slides, so I'm going to be talking kind of fast. But we'll flip through these. But these were some of the examples that I gave in my article. We're basically showing what other cities and municipalities are doing and other countries are doing to integrate housing into their particular condition. And I felt that most of the good examples are actually coming from either other states, other countries, or other cities. We didn't have a lot of good examples to show here. So that's why I went beyond and abroad to bring the examples here. But in doing so, we can keep on flipping. So today, go back to that one. So today I wanted to focus on a couple of things in my op-ed piece, really getting down to what's happening, what has happened with zoning, discussing this notion of, this is what I call objective versus subjective beauty, and is zoning really giving us better architecture? Is it giving us better neighborhoods? Well, if we're getting a lot of what we're getting right now. I'm not sure zoning is going to reach the way zoning is written. Now, I don't know what the exact answer is, but I have done some research. And you guys have probably done more research than I have, because like I said, I'm not embedded in the multifamily housing market or any of your neighborhoods. But I know how to design. And I know what it takes to understand context and the research that it takes to really do something appropriate for a condition, whatever that condition is. Whether it's we do municipal buildings all over the U.S., we do retail, we do restaurants, whatever that condition is, we do research. We try to understand the existing context and condition. Now, I believe what's missing, and I believe one of the big components that's missing in the zoning is actually what I call heart and soul, that we've lost it. That zoning has become, even though it's form-based, zoning has become very prescriptive and product-oriented. If you can go through zoning and meet all the requirements and come up with, pardon my expression, a piece of crap as a housing building or any building, then that means zoning is actually starting to prescribe product. Zoning should actually be prescribing process, not product. That's one of the problems with zoning right now, is you can use it, you can go through it, and you can create a product with it because that's what it's here. And basically, when that happens, you're looking for loopholes to do the product cheaper and cheaper. If zoning was more process-oriented, in other words, it told you that, look, you need to understand the context of the neighborhood. You need to understand the heart and soul of that neighborhood. You need to understand that your building needs to have a narrative. You need to understand that the aggregation of buildings is what creates sense of place. That you need to understand all these things. The little setbacks and the bulk plans and all these other things, they're there, they're functional. They need to happen. They're shelter oriented. But what we've lost and what we're losing in Denver is actually this notion of sense of place, the heart and soul of each community. And I know we'll keep going through here through the slides. So we're getting things like this. And what we're getting, next one as well, what we're getting is we're getting sort of bad studies and what you can do with the outsides of buildings. That's it. It becomes facade treatment. And that's because Denver allows you to do that. You meet all the requirements, you meet the prescriptive requirements. Then basically you can come in and sort of do whatever you want on the outside. Essentially it's becoming abstract art. It's not architecture anymore because it's facade treatment. It's not creating space or place. And that's one of the problems. That's what I want to get into here. So let's keep going. Let's keep going through here. Now, certain cities have very sort of significant components, environmental conditions to them. One city might be Vancouver. If you think about Vancouver, what is it then? Well, it's got a huge water feature, huge lake river. It's got great views of the mountains in the background. The city and the way buildings are positioned around that lake and towards the views is those major components that have actually been the things that have influenced the way buildings are placed, the heights of buildings, and the way they actually surround and create an enclosure to that lake there. So what happened in Vancouver is they recognized very critical conditions that existed. Now what critical conditions, what things do we have in Colorado? What things do we have in our neighborhoods that we can use to then say, hey, wait a minute, if we're going to create something special, if we're going to enrich our neighborhoods, then we should be recognizing what those special things are. Now, from a regional standpoint, it could be something as simple as saying, look, we live in a semi-arid climate. Water is really important. So maybe the way roofs are shaped and the idea that they're collecting water and where that water is going is going to give form to buildings. Not the Denver code that says you've got to do this, but the environmental condition that says maybe we should be thinking about giving our architecture and giving Denver something special by recognizing what we have here. Maybe it's the regional climatic condition that we start to look at. Maybe it's the fact that when you go to other cities, you look up at the sky in Seattle, or even you go to Atlanta and look up, it's cloudy a lot, it's humid. You go here, it's beautiful. The sky is beautiful. What's happening to the tops of our buildings? They're being cut off, they're flat, they're not activated, there's nothing going on at the top. In fact, those five-story podium buildings that are going up around here usually have nothing on top. They're trying to get rid of the top. What happens if the tops of our buildings actually begin to express the openness of the sky? So we start thinking about that as giving form. So form comes from our conditions here. It shouldn't be coming from zoning prescribing that form needs to be based on this and that, because that's the criteria we've used for 50 years. And it has been around for a long time. Even though zoning has changed, it really hasn't evolved very much. Keep going through here, and I'll talk about a couple of things. So if you look at what we've been doing, what most zoning is throughout the U.S., it's pretty similar. It's either prescriptive or form-based. It gives you the same, basically the outcome or the output or the product when you look at zoning can be the same here as it is in Seattle, as it is in Atlanta. And that's why they took the op-ed piece and reproduced it and realized, geez, we're having the same problems here. It's because of the way zoning is written. There's a missing link that's going on. Well, that missing link is actually something called, that I'm sure many of you are aware of, is something called heart and soul based zoning. I'm sure many of you have probably read about it or heard about it, but it's being used in different, Golden actually initiated a process several years ago to begin to think about what their community is and what they should be saying and what new construction and new design should be speaking to when you build inside Golden. And where did that come from? Well, there's an organization, if you don't know about it, there's an organization that's written a paper. I've been reading up for several weeks since I wrote that op-ed piece because I feel like I needed to understand exactly what's going on with different zoning. But this is a field guide to heart, to basically understanding heart and soul. Now what this is, I'm distilling it for the amount of time I have to speak, but what this gets into is saying that, look, we're missing something. Zoning is missing something. Maybe communities need to initiate this themselves, but somehow it needs to layer into zoning. And that's that every neighborhood, every community, every city has some kind of narrative. The people living in those cities and communities have great stories, have great narratives to tell. And that when they tell those stories and they tell those narratives, that certain values come out of those stories and narratives. Those values then become the things that you put in the code, you put in zoning and say, these are the values that we want to make sure enrich our neighborhoods.
Can you give us the name of that group or the website?
Sure. In fact, I can give it, I have it all here, so I can give it to you. I can give it to you at the end, but the group is called the Orton, O-R-T-O-N, Orton Family Foundation. And if you Google heart and soul based zoning or just heart and soul based planning, it'll come up. Now, I thought I was being very clever when I wrote the op-ed. I actually wrote heart and soul, we lost the heart and soul. I wrote it in the op-ed piece. And then after writing it, I said, I wonder if anybody's doing this stuff. I Googled it, and there's like 300 tags you can go to. So somebody's already thought about it. But heart and soul based zoning is actually a different way. It's actually a different way to ensure that your neighborhood and the characteristics that make your neighborhood special remain. And that actually new construction, new architecture, whether it's infill, whether it's connected to existing buildings, whatever it is, that new stuff is actually enriching the condition that exists in your neighborhood, enriching the values that you've all established for your neighborhoods. The first step is actually establishing what those values are. And the values don't come from these sort of stoic, over-the-table sessions where people are saying, well, what do we want to have happen in our neighborhood? They actually come from stories. They actually come from narratives. Stories from people that have lived in the neighborhoods for a long time. From those stories, values are then ascertained. Those values are personal values. Those personal values then become core values. And typically neighborhoods might have, when you use this process, might have 10 or 12 core values. Now those core values should be the values that are in the code or in some kind of neighborhood design review committee, ordinance, whatever it is, that they're in there, and any new construction has to recognize those values. They have to tell you how they're taking those values and making the space, the place, better, enriching your neighborhood. Because density is going to happen. Growth is going to happen. That's not the question. The question is, how can that growth actually enrich the condition that exists right now? So those things are out there. Now, that's out there. that Heart and Soul based zoning. There's something else out there that was uncovered just recently, and I don't know if any of you have heard of this, and that's called the missing middle. How many of you have heard of that concept, the missing middle? So some of you are aware of this, but the missing middle is something that I think is that sort of came from this sort of blatant disregard for the scale of single family moving to a higher density. In other words, if I take a single family neighborhood and then all of a sudden I put what I call a podium building, a five-story concrete-based apartment block right next to that condition of single family, I've disregarded the scale context. I've increased zoning, I've increased density, but I've disregarded the connection to that neighborhood. Missing middle says there actually should be a variety of housing typologies that allow you to grow from single family up to that larger density scale. The missing middle is something that we are missing, actually, in a lot of communities. It's not in zoning. Zoning actually allows you to do all these different typology of housing, but if they allow you to do that five-story banal box, I called it, and that can happen right next to a single family home, then zoning hasn't recognized the missing middle. The missing middle is really an important component of a neighborhood being able to embrace growth, accept growth, and realize that it can actually enhance the condition of the neighborhood. And by what's interesting about missing middle, and we'll keep cycling through this because I'm sure I won't get through all this stuff. I got a whole bunch of slides. This is really something that the whole idea, that's why I wrote the op-ed piece, because it really is concerning to me, and it can go off in a number of different directions. But the missing middle says there are typologies of housing that we aren't developing right now that could be developed much less expensively. Floor plates can be smaller. We can get the higher density by shrinking the floor plate. We don't need to create large floor plates and stack them up. There's a typology called a bungalow courtyard. That's one of the typologies of missing middle. Bungalow courtyard says, hey, what we can do is make smaller floor plates, create a courtyard building. The front of that building actually looks like houses, but the courtyard actually now feeds maybe 11 units back in there. Each one is 500 square feet. Well, yes, that's small housing. That increases density. But the physical influence, the physical impact of that is much less than what we're doing with the traditional typologies now. The construction of that typology, of the one-story courtyard bungalow, the construction of that is just like a house. So construction dollars actually go down. In Denver code right now, if you come under a certain square footage for a house, I can't remember the exact number, say it's 400 square feet, you don't have to park it one per one. You can actually park one per five or one per seven, depending on the size of that unit. Parking's a big issue. I know that when you get into these neighborhoods. But if you have a walkable neighborhood, if you have a neighborhood where the resources are walkable, are close, then you can actually use these typologies to increase density and not change the character of the neighborhood. These are the kind of things that we're missing right now. These are the kind of things that aren't being floated around. And the reason is because developers, architects, and others realize that there's a formula that works right now. That five-story podium building works. It works financially. It doesn't necessarily work for the neighborhood, though. And that's where we need to get back into this and figure out what we can do to enhance and make these neighborhoods and make these enrich the lives of the people in the neighborhoods. Now, we talked about in my article, I mentioned it too, that one of the most difficult things to do is to sit across from the table with somebody and say, you know, well, yes, you met all the zoning criteria, but it's ugly. Because ugly a lot of times is in the eye of the beholder. Somebody might say something is beautiful, somebody might say something is ugly. Now you can get, there are tools available to you to be able to look at something and say, you know, it's ugly and here's why it's ugly. Well, our brain actually functions in sort of interesting ways. If we can go to the next slide, I'll talk to you about something. There's areas of our brain that function quite differently. So when we sense something like fear, something is being triggered in our brain. So that's a sense. We know where that happens because neuroscience and neuro research has recognized that. That we know that fear is triggered in a certain part of the brain. We also know that same part of the brain actually gets stimulated by discordant geometry. by angular geometry, by incomplete geometry. And so if you want to promote fear, then go ahead and build something like that thing on the right there. Well, that's a Holocaust museum. He wanted to promote fear in that building.
It's kind of like our
architect. It's like our, it's the same architect.
Yes.
That's the same architect. So now, and that's an interesting point, because now, sometimes you don't realize that form can actually trigger certain conditions or certain thoughts, but it does. Form can do that. These are studies. There's two major studies out of neuroscience and neuroaesthetics that actually talk about what's beautiful and what isn't, and what's triggering fear and what's triggering pleasure. Actually, what triggers pleasure? So if we look at the slide on the left, well, there's another portion of the brain that actually gets triggered when you see things that you really like. And what is triggering in there? What's triggering there is the same emotive trigger that happens when if I come up to you and I smile, and I go like this, that most of the time the trigger is not going to be like this most of the time. The trigger is going to be more emotive than that. Well, that same piece, that same component of the brain actually is triggered when you look at things that have organic shape, curved form, they have consistency, symmetry, they have a geometry that you can understand, you can complete. So all of a sudden, we're starting to talk about things that make architecture, make good architecture. You look at traditional architecture and you can see, boy, you can walk up to something and say, boy, I like that, I don't know why I like it. But there actually is neuroscience, neuro research that tells us why we do like something. So beauty can actually be objectified. It's not all subjective, as many zoning ordinances and codes would make you think. Go to the next slide. So when we see these shapes, these curved, sinuous shapes, we're actually, something is actually triggering in us. The pleasure stimulation is being triggered right there. And the next slide. Now, through the ages, Plato, Aristotle, they've all tried to uncover the meaning of beauty, and they've all tried to establish it mainly an objective standpoint pre-18th century. It was mainly objective. After the 18th century, it was somewhat subjective. Now it's coming back to defining what's happening is we're trying to define beauty in a more objective manner. Beauty was defined early before the 18th century. Beauty was actually defined in terms of the tradition of columns, symmetry, base shaft, top. Some of the things that we know and we look at, we don't realize we like, but it actually comes from that description of beauty in the past. Now that gives us traditional architecture, but contemporary architecture can recognize base, shaft, top, it can recognize repetitive rhythm, it can recognize scale, proportion, it can recognize something that architects would call the golden section or the golden triangle, which is a proportional system based on the way our body parts are arranged. All that came from pre-18th century. Well, those are components of objectifying beauty. So you can actually respond to somebody's piece of architecture and say, you know, that's not beautiful. That's not going to enrich our neighborhood, and here's why. That's a tool that you can have. You can actually do the research and find that is available to you. So keep going through here. And then there's another science, or actually another way to look at how we think about light, daylight, how we think about responding to conditions like wind, air, sky, and that's called phenomenology. And that's getting into this notion that when we talk about daylight in the building code, typically we talk about daylight like, okay, let's add windows because we need to get more daylight. The code prescribes that you must have windows at least this big for a unit or a room in the unit. The code says that. But what the code doesn't talk about is what we call phenomenology, and that's the way our body actually responds to the changing rhythms of sun. Well, architecture can actually be designed to clue into what's happening as the sun goes across the sky. Architecture, we'll go to the next one. Architecture can actually be designed to capture light. So all of a sudden the monitors that capture light to bring it inside, to give us daylight, all of a sudden they're responding to the condition, to the environmental condition, and they're creating form based on what they're doing. So it's not a preconceived notion of what a building can be. It's actually looking at the conditions that exist here in our environment and say, we can make buildings special because those buildings can respond to our special conditions. The fact that we get daylight for this period of time, the fact that we are somewhat dry and semi-arid, where does the water go? Where do we collect it? How precious is it? What's the sound of water? What happens if I find out through my research that, and we're doing this right now, what happens if I find out through my research that a site that we're looking at was actually an apple grove in the past, and that we can't replant the apple grove? Maybe we can borrow from the notion of apple grove and what the apple grove created. It created a canopy of trees. It created a canopy of leaves. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the facades of our building, and we're going to develop a screen pattern laser cut out of the shapes in between all the leaves of the apple tree, and that creates the facade of our building. And the shadow that's created by that texture is actually bringing us back abstractly to the past of that building. We're trying to find the narrative. We're trying to find the story that connects architecture past, connects architecture back to something that existed before. That's when architecture becomes special, and that's when it starts to have meaning. So when we talk about this notion of, we can keep going, when we talk about this notion of zoning, what it's doing, and how we can make, how architects, neighborhoods, developers can get together and create an architecture that's special, that actually enhances your neighborhood. We have to look for those narratives, and we have to look for those stories. That's that component that I think that's missing right now. That's the next step in basically my process in saying, okay, I identified a problem in my op-ed. I think now we can start looking at what kind of things we can think about that will make that will actually solve the condition that's happening right now. That will give us stronger, better architecture that will enrich the lives of the people in the neighborhoods. But in order to do that, we kind of have to blow up some of the thinking of the past. And we have to really start thinking about what's important. What are those values and goals and qualities of our various neighborhoods? That's important. So your stories, the stories that you can tell about the past, the history, connection to the past in your neighborhood, all those things, your stories can actually be used to begin to generate what these qualities are. And I think that's missing right now. It's missing in many of the neighborhoods. That can come from the ground, it can come from the neighborhood itself, or it can come from zoning down. But I guarantee it's going to be better if it comes from the ground up. And then it eventually gets to zoning. So that last statement there, and we'll go back to that one, says that zoning should encourage a process, not a problem. Yeah. That's a very important statement because it's not doing that right now. Zoning should actually, maybe zoning, what it should be, is actually it should be a repository for the information that you have about your neighborhood and about the narratives and the stories. Maybe it should be that. Maybe zoning should be the resource that you can go to find all this information. Maybe zoning should be the place where the newest and coolest ideas about how to deal with the collection of water, or how to deal with shading a building that is there. We know it's on the internet, we can go get it, but maybe zone control should be shifting and changing. Maybe it should become that place where you can get the information you need to actually do architecture that's appropriate to the neighborhoods, that's appropriate to the building typology that you're doing. So that's a shift, that's a change in paradigm, a change in thinking about where zoning might go, what zoning might think about. So it's adding another layer to zoning. And I think that layer is the thing that's right now, that missing layer is basically causing us to do stuff that could be done anyway. You could take most of the new architecture that's done here in your neighborhood, any neighborhood around here, you could plot it down in any neighborhood you in the U.S. and nobody would know. And if you can do that, then that means it doesn't mean anything. It has no connection to your neighborhood or your community. That's the depth of research, study, design that needs to be taking place. My group, the American Institute of Architects, the architects, they need to start doing that too. Now, yes, I know fees are low and doing housing, boy, you don't have a lot of time to do this stuff, but that's what we do. We enrich the lives of people living in neighborhoods. We should be doing that. We're not doing it enough. We're not doing it enough right now. Nobody is doing it enough. So we'll go on to the next go on to the next slide. We'll just flip through. We'll flip through a couple of these, but these are some examples of what I was talking about. When you can deal with things like light and sunlight and shade and creating depth to buildings. Looking at a piece of property that you're dealing with. This is a school right now that we're dealing with. It's going to be totally, because the site is so tight, we couldn't figure out where the play yards are. So we actually took the site and bent it up over the top of the school. And it's becoming the playground and the play area for the school. So the school is completely hidden underground. It's got windows on the side, it's got daylight coming down to courtyards, but recognizing the condition of the site, that it had rolling hills, and that we could make our own hill, and that the building itself would become a hill, that allowed us to rethink about architecture. That it's not about just taking a program and immediately trying to figure out how many bedrooms or how many units you can get in. It's about taking a site and really understanding its past, its history, and what it can do to make something very special. Buildings can make place. They can create a sense of place. But it's an aggregation of buildings that really need to come together to create place. So it's not just one building typically, it's many buildings. So that's why we need to get architects who are working on all these projects together to understand that your building, yes, can be special. But many times, it's important that we look at, based on budget, or we look at based on the typology, that not every building has to scream out, look at me. And what's happening in the context of a lot of these five-story podium buildings right now is everyone's trying to make their building a little more special than the other by doing something weirder and weirder with windows, materials, colors, whatever it is. They're just trying to make it more weird. They're not becoming better, they're just becoming different. And different definitely doesn't mean better. So we need to get at basically what we're trying to get at, and what my point is today, one of the major points is that buildings need to be layered with meaning, much deeper meaning than they are right now. And it's not that difficult to do it. Because we can rely on you, we can rely on your narratives, your stories, your values, the neighborhood values, and we can enrich those buildings by giving them basically the architecture that speaks to the narratives that you've come up with. Now we've looked at a couple of things. On some projects we're working on now that might have, say, if we're dealing with a site that, say, is located in an area, one of our sites we're looking at now, we used to be owned by DiNardo Market, so we know that family, through the years, it started as an agricultural family, they had a farm. And so we would actually look at an agrarian-shaped building. We'd look at the shape of an agrarian structure and say, can we abstract, can we take that from the past and begin to use that as a way to develop what's an appropriate architecture for a five-story building, even for a three-story building. So we're trying to give meaning by looking at the past of these buildings. We'll flip through here, and we'll keep on going. So one of the projects that we're working on right now is located in Fort Collins. This is an old feeding grain building right here. Nobody can figure out what to do with it. It has no windows in it. Fort Collins, it's on the historic register, it's in the downtown area of Fort Collins. So we looked at it in quite a different way. We said, well, we need to add square footage to it. Historical doesn't want us to slam something into it that looks like it's a space shack, you know, that's for sure. In fact, usually what you want to do is you want to keep as far away from the building as you can, but make what you've done look like it was done in this period and not when that building was built. Yet at the same time, the new building needs to respect the old building. And so some of the ideas that we're looking at, and I'll show these in the next couple of slides, this one on the left is basically taking the notion, and here's where thinking and layering and depth comes into. That building used to hold grain. So that means that came from the land. The grain feed came from the land somewhere. So they've taken their crops, they put them in that storage building, and over the years that's what it's done. It stored grain. It didn't store people. So it's a solid building. Now, we want to give life back to this site. Our addition is storing people. In order to give life, we need to give daylight. And so our building now is a greenhouse. It's actually cycling through. They got the grain, they put it in the building, they sent it out somewhere. Our building is now creating new life. In order to create new life, we need light. And when we're thinking about getting light, then we say, well, why don't we do a greenhouse? Why don't we make our addition look like and be a greenhouse? Now, that's basically, if you look at them, they're not of the same era, they're not of the same year, but they're speaking to each other in some way. The existing building is solid, our building is transparent, we have a roof, we kind of mimic the shape of the other roof. So there are ways in any type of project to look at the past, look at the history, and generate something that respects that, but can also speak to today and be compatible with what was existing before. That can happen with housing. We did other studies for the building. We recognized that a railroad track used to run by this building, so we took the proportions of a railroad car. And we said, what if we took that proportion, lifted it off the ground, that became a second story deck that you could look down over a courtyard, and therefore now we've got a building that speaks to its past, but we've got a new building that's speaking to the heritage of what existed before, how they got all the grains to the site and off the site. Those are different ways to think about what you can do to add on to a historic building. And finally, after going through those two schemes, we actually looked back and we said, wait a minute, we're not creating a building here. We're creating a space, not a building. That what we should be doing is figuring out how to enliven the space, enliven the zone between the old and the new. And so now what we've done is we've created a stage, not a building. And so that slide on the right is actually showing that now we have an activated two-story indoor-outdoor space. The whole building has garage doors on it. The whole thing opens up. It opens into a corridor. The corridor gets more daylight because we put a slice at a 45-degree angle through the new building to widen the corridor, widen the condition between the two. All those kind of things can be looked at in any type of building. So in other words, housing can be looked at in the same way. You can look at existing buildings and you can figure out how to add on to them, how to enrich the old and make the new even better as well. It's something that's missing in a lot of the projects that are going on right now. This is retail, restaurant, other things. There's no reason why you can't use the same thinking and thought process in housing projects. It can happen. You can enrich neighborhoods and you can keep old buildings and you can figure out ways to add new to them as well. It can happen. It's not that hard. We've done it with a couple of projects. If you like sushi, you might have been to Sushi Den or Izakaya Den. That's one of our buildings. One of the important aspects of this building right here was to figure out how the building could make a transition from the one-story houses around it and the one-story building right next door up to the two-story that's existing to the right. So our building's right there in the middle. The existing building is off to the right. Well, in looking at how we can make that transition from one to two stories, we looked at the fact that, well, maybe we need to really pull out a major part of our building, or maybe we need to subtract from our building, that we need to create emptiness in our building. So if you go to the next slide, and this is the last, maybe what we need to do is figure out ways where our building can become so transparent and so kinetic that it's actually able to move from one story to two story just by the way we do things. Apertures, large windows, whatever happens in this building, it's all proportioned and based on what we grab from the neighborhood, what we grab from the context of the surroundings. You don't know, yes, you could look at it and say, well, it had to come from this century because I don't know who can do a 12-foot tall window that hinges out like that, but we figured out how to do it. But we also figured out that as we were tearing down what existed on this site, we found about 400 square feet of clay tile inside. Well, the outside of this building is actually clad in that clay tile, but it's actually turned backwards. The clay tile is turned backwards because it had even more texture on its backside. And so we're always looking for interesting ways to link and tie our buildings back into the community. Those are the kind of things that can and should happen with new architecture and should happen with housing and neighborhoods. It's not happening right now, but it can happen. And that's it.